There are 25 million homes in the UK, but less than 5% have home security. SimpliSafe is changing that. Our goal is simple: to make home safe for everyone. Not with false security, but with real protection. A night watch for your home, a day watch too. Engineered with a single focus: to protect. Built with unprecedented safeguards against power cuts, downed Wi-Fi, cut landlines, bats, hammers, and everything in between. Not one room protection, whole home protection. A collection of beautifully designed cameras and sensors. Sensors so small, they're practically invisible. Designed to disappear into your home and blanket it with protection. So precise, they can tell the difference between the family pet and an intruder. More than easy to use, downright delightful. Everything soft and smooth to the touch, with gentle reminders when a window is left open, and urgency in moments of crisis. All at prices that are fair and honest. We're more than 10 years in, protecting over 3 million Americans, and now we're here to do the same in the UK. Meet SimpliSafe. Home security done right.
You're in the right place at the right time, and this is The Strangeness, a podcast exploring unsolved mysteries and inexplicable events. My name is Adrian Asahi, your faithful guide into the unknown. If you've got anything that you think the show ought to cover, please send me an email at adrian.thestrangeness@gmail.com. That's adrian.thestrangeness@gmail.com. Today's show is sponsored by SimpliSafe. So, if you want to make your home safer in the UK or US, check out SimpliSafe. You might not know this, but people sometimes stop me in the street and ask, "Sorry, are you Adrian from the Strangeness podcast?" And I say, yeah, I am Adrian from the Strangeness podcast. And they say, "Adrian, what do you use to keep your home safe? Is it simple?" And I say, "Yeah, SimpliSafe sent me a free SimpliSafe." They say, "How's it make you feel?" And I say, "Well, SimpliSafe." Jokes aside, it's a great product. Check them out. Welcome back to the show, everyone. It's good to be back. What a week it's been. Heat waves, forest fires, political scandals, global pandemic and sustained lockdowns. All the usual, really. But really, I hope you're all staying safe and having a good Friday evening. And if you're catching up on this in the week, well, maybe you can pretend it's Friday. So, I suggest you pour yourselves a drink, climb into something comfortable, and on this one, you might also want to lock the doors and turn off the lights, because tonight, things are going to get strange. As usual, I want to thank you, the members and listeners. I wouldn't be able to do this without the contributions, subscriptions, and advice that I receive from you and the community that you've built around this show. So, if you're not already a member and you'd like to support the show, it would be hugely appreciated. By signing up to the Patreon, you'll be helping me out, but you'll also get access to additional content, like behind-the-scenes reports, exclusive interviews, and unlimited membership to the Strangeness forums. For the price of around one coffee or beer a month, you can keep the show alive and help it to continue to grow. Over the last 2 years, we've gone from having 5 listeners to thousands of downloads a week. That's all DIY, it's all grassroots, and it's all thanks to you. So again, thank you so much for supporting The Strangeness. Speaking of which, a lot of you have brought this up in the Discord, and on Twitter, and on Telegram. Yes, we do have a new design for the show image. Thanks for checking that out. And yes, there is a typo. The show is not called The Strangeness, and it definitely is called The Strangeness. We've asked the platforms to update it. They've said that they're all going to do that. So do check your podcast players out this week and let me know whether or not it's fixed at your end. Anyway, I'm sure that you don't want to hear me ramble on. So, let's get to it. And hey, I've got a hell of a series lined up for you over the next few episodes. Before we get going, I ought to tell you that I get more emails from members of the community about the topic of these episodes than almost anything else. And between us, I've been keen to grapple with it too, and I've actually had it on the back burner for a while. The reason I've waited to do this is because it encompasses so strange a series of events that these shows needed some pretty serious groundwork. Back when I initially thought about doing this series, I was mostly trying to work out where the on button was on my microphone. Now, I like to think that my research and writing has improved over the last 150 episodes, and I certainly hope so, because the more that you look into the material we'll be dealing with tonight, the more complex it seems to become. Indeed, over the course of the next few episodes, we will explore a supposed pattern of strange disappearances and mysterious deaths, one so large and so complicated that it certainly warrants our consideration. Now, patterns of this type have been discussed in pop culture for years, and we've even covered some of these on past episodes. For instance, we looked into disappearing colonies in the early Americas back in episode 11, aircraft awry in the Bermuda Triangle in episode 32, and even the historic disappearance of ships and their crews like the HMS Terror in the Arctic Circle, which we covered just a few weeks ago. Admittedly, we do cover history as much as we do mystery here, but I think that I learned from those episodes that you lot seem to love a good cold case. And after all, things lost beg finding, and things unfound do make for great discussion. And as many of you pointed out when you voted on what I should cover next, one such pattern has risen to the fore in recent years, becoming wildly popular in many different circles. Indeed, these cold cases seem to appeal to people from across the now aligned worlds of true crime, conservation, and even conspiracy theory culture. And that is because the pattern with which this series is concerned relates to more than 1,500 disappearances in the national parks of North America. But before we begin, I want to direct your attention to some of our source material for these episodes. Primarily, David Palaides, a man whose name you may have heard. If you're familiar with the idea of a pattern of strange disappearances all across North America, then you're probably familiar with David. He's a retired police detective and the author of multiple true crime publications, including his popular series on the topic of strange disappearances, Missing 411. Now, thanks to a listener who sent me Palaides' books some years ago, I have managed to read most of his work. Personally, I find it data-heavy, and his cases do read more like formal police reports than pop history. But perhaps that focus on straight-talking detail is why so many readers find them both compelling and digestible. We'll learn more about Palaides and his pattern later. I should note that because that pattern encompasses so many cases, I've picked some of the more famous ones to focus on here. I've prepared a script for the episode as usual, and I have my trusty notes with me at the microphone as always. However, I don't want this series to be all about my opinion, so I've also started reaching out to people involved in these cases themselves, and I hope to feature some of their perspectives on future episodes in this series. Of course, these episodes will span the next 3 weeks, so if anybody has anything they can tip me off on that I can look into, I'd love to do some primary research. And of course, this isn't a conspiracy theory show, but this subject is loaded with conspiracy theories, so if anybody has any pet theories of their own, I would love to hear them. Drop me a line. Where I manage to get interviews, the full audio will be uploaded to the Patreon for members as usual. That said, I imagine that key extracts will end up in these public shows too. And as to format, for anyone unfamiliar with the structure of our series here at The Strangeness, this first episode will introduce the strangeness at hand, laying out the mystery. And in subsequent episodes, I will then do my best to solve it, or at least to cast some new light on its complexities. Throughout all this then, I want you to keep 3 questions in mind. These are the same questions I asked myself when I started doing the research for this episode. Those questions are, is there a pattern here at all? If there is, what could be its causes? And if a pattern exists, why do so few people seem to know about it? And now that you have a roadmap for the episode, let's jump in to a particularly interesting case, one that rather sets the tone. Jared Atadero vanished on October 2nd, 1999, in the Comanche Peak Wilderness. The only son of hotel owner Alan Atadero, Jared was 3 years old at the time. Imagine you're a kid. Your name is Jared Atadero. You were 3 years old and you live with your dad at the family-owned bed and breakfast on the edge of the Comanche Peak Wilderness, part of the conjoined Rocky Mountain National Park and Roosevelt National Forest. This is a remote location, but one that's popular with fishermen, hunters, and hikers alike. These people each need a place to rest, eat, and gather supplies before heading out into the surrounding 3,000 square miles of enduringly pristine wilderness. Business is fantastic, and summer has been exceptionally busy at the hotel. A group of Christian missionaries have even taken rooms there for several months, where they've been helping with chores, and they've even looked after you on many occasions. But it's autumn now, and things have started to quieten. And on the morning of October the 2nd, the missionaries plan to drive up to a nearby fishery in the mountains. You are fascinated by fish, and you plead with your dad to let them take you with them. Having grown familiar with these guests, Alan agrees, so long as you are also watched closely by your older sister, Jocelyn. The last thing Alan recalls from that morning is that he did not tie your shoes because you hated them being tied. And in a 2017 interview with David Pilates, he recalls the blue cotton pants and beige jumper he dressed you in that morning. Unknown to Alan, the missionaries decide to drive an extra 15 miles to take a short walk up the nearby Big South Trail. You and your sister are sandwiched between two small groups, but as the trail steepens, those behind stop to catch their breath. The two of you round a bend, and Jocelyn is momentarily distracted. And when she turns to show you whatever she has seen, you are gone. She shouts for you, and your supposed supervisors come running up the trail. Those ahead come running back. Neither has seen you on their way. They call your name, looking to each side of the path. Less than 5 minutes have passed since you were last seen, and it's unreasonable to assume that you could have wandered very far in that time, but there's still no response. At this point, several missionaries rush back to the hotel to raise the alarm. On hearing about your disappearance, Alan jumps into his truck and drives 20 minutes to the trailhead. He's already phoned for help, and soon numerous park rangers arrive. They check the area for tracks, take statements, and in less than an hour, a search and rescue operation has been called into the Comanche Peak. As these experts prepare for the mission ahead, darkness falls on the Big South Trail. But this is where things get weird, because after more than 1 week, no one has found you, or even any trace of your leaving the trail. Despite good conditions, search dogs refuse to follow your scent. Likewise, experienced trackers are unable to find your footprints, despite the muddy ground. 500,000 volunteers comb the woods for nearly a mile on each side of the trail, but they find no shreds of clothing or dropped possessions, nor the blood that would be expected in the case of an animal attack. Search and rescue teams check ravines, peaks, boulder fields in the area, but without any luck. Rangers interview the missionaries, family members, and anyone known to have been on this or any other nearby trail. But everyone has an alibi for the time of your disappearance. No one even heard you cry out. And so it's almost as if you vanished into thin air. And without any leads, officials postpone the search, leaving Alan to wonder what happened to you, his son. Had the story ended there, it is unlikely to have attracted Pilates. But it didn't end there at all. Because 4 years later, on June the 4th, 2003, walkers Rob Osborne and Gareth Watts were hiking in the mountains beyond the Big South Trail. And when crossing a boulder field nearly 5 miles from the point at which Jared disappeared, they stumbled across something unusual between several granite boulders. Hundreds of feet above the trail, over terrain that presents a challenge even to seasoned hikers like themselves, Watts and Osborne found a pile of tiny clothes. Blue cotton pants and a beige jumper, and, neatly placed between two rocks, a pair of green and white sneakers. The clothes were like new. No dirt, no mud, no stains, no weather damage even. It was as if these items had been placed here recently. Perplexed by this assortment, Watts and Osborne looked around the scene, and a few metres further into the boulder field, placed on a freshly fallen tree branch, they discovered a single, clean, white bone. The pair rushed back down the trail and made a hasty call to local authorities. On their collection by park rangers, these clothes were presented to Alan Atadero. He recognized them, and several days later, the bone fragment returned from police labs. It was identified as a piece of skull and a DNA match for Jared. But to complicate matters further, the location in which these artifacts were discovered, that boulder field and the clearing, had actually been examined during the initial search and rescue effort back in October 99. So, your name is Jared Atadero, and now National Park authorities say that you were taken from the Big South Trail in the Comanche Peak Wilderness. Although your clothes were found undamaged by claws or teeth or the elements, despite your journey across 5 miles of rugged mountain terrain, and despite the fact that your unlaced shoes should have fallen off in any struggle with an animal, the same National Park authorities now blame your abduction on a mountain lion. But I've checked the figures on this, and mountain lions are only known to have attacked humans 25 times in the last 3 decades, with only 40 recorded fatalities in the last 2 centuries. Mountain lions also attack the neck and the stomach, leaving bloody wounds. And of course, they are not known to undress their prey, or fold their clothes, or to place these items unscathed and almost ceremonially atop fallen logs on popular trails to which people will someday return. Besides which, this conclusion does not match up with the guidance of experts outside the National Parks Service. Because after 400 tests carried out by a mixture of police and university labs at the expense of Alan Atadero, no fur, saliva, or other traces of any predatory animals have ever been found on any of the clothing. So, taking all of this on board, are we really supposed to believe that Jared undressed himself before being taken by a lion? That someone else found his clothes and that rather than calling the police, they preserved these items for years? That these were then carried up a mountain range and then left there to be found? And are we supposed to believe that the National Park Service does not find this at all suspicious? Or that they don't want to talk to whoever it was that folded the clothes, then arrayed them in the path of other people, not unlike a grave? As you can probably tell, I don't think that makes sense at all. And of all the stories I could have picked from Pilates' books, I chose the disappearance of Jared Atadero because it seems to best exemplify 2 cornerstones of the mystery he has popularized. On the one hand, it's a disappearance with some strange qualities, like the absence of tracks and the search dogs that refuse to follow a scent. And on the other, it's a case in which the National Park Service failed to follow up on overwhelming evidence of an abduction. Indeed, these are the essential criteria for Pilates to consider a case. But before we go any further, I think it would make sense to examine Pilates a little, and the pattern he associates with cases such as this. To understand Pilates and his pattern, I think you need to understand the context in which he works. And when I look back at this topic of strange disappearances, something became quickly apparent. There is no notable beginning to the history of missing persons cases, because people have always disappeared. There's nothing inherently odd about that. After all, we're foolish and curious creatures. We're inclined to wander away from the tribe, become confused, and often die lonely deaths. Since time immemorial, we've fallen prey to both the elements and animals, including other humans. We frequently eat the wrong berries or mushrooms, stumble into deadly marshes, ravines and caverns, contract diseases far from our medicine people, slip into tar pits, drown in rivers, break limbs, or otherwise simply starve to death because we're underprepared for the terrain. And sometimes, perhaps, stranger things might also happen to us in the wilderness. At any rate, my point is that dying alone is nothing new to mankind. For this reason, I should start by saying that far more people go missing in the States than the roughly 1,500 individuals covered in detail in Pylades' books. Though many of these people are found, either dead or alive, many others are not. The problem, and it's a problem at the heart of what David Pylades does, is that it can be hard to pin down these cases because no national database for missing persons exists. In fact, the closest thing to a national database is an expanding digital map created by Pylades. Why, you ask, is there no national database for missing persons? Well, I did some digging, and there are a number of reasons. Not least the fact that the United States aren't all that united at times. For instance, federal law enforcement agencies only investigate missing persons under certain circumstances, like when they have evidence of a kidnapping. And unless they're chasing an interstate criminal or network of organized crime, these agencies will only find out about a case when it's reported to them by local law enforcement. Muddying those waters, these local law enforcement branches tend to operate independent of one another, separating centralized groups like state troopers and highway police from individual police departments, themselves overseen by community sheriffs and chiefs. In other words, this law enforcement machine is vast. It runs on a variety of systems that don't plug into each other without considerable effort, and it's typically managed at a very local level by people with highly specific jurisdictions, each trying to apply laws that differ not only from one state to another, but also, sometimes, from county to county. And to complicate matters, and this is important where it relates to David Pylades, North America is covered with huge swathes of protected wildland. Taken collectively, this amounts to an area similar in size to the whole of Central Europe. By comparison, our European national parks seem kind of quaint. These American wildlands are then subdivided into a mixture of national parks, national forests, wilderness zones, and forestry districts, all classified as federal land. That places such wilderness areas beyond the jurisdiction of the states in which they exist, and these lands are governed instead by the US Department of the Interior and its subsidiary, the National Parks Service. In terms of law enforcement, then, the Parks Service have their own agencies. When I started doing research for this episode, I looked these up, and I was pretty surprised at their scale. I knew about the Rangers, the Parks Police Force, but I had no idea that the National Park Service commands a fully functional Air Force, or a freshwater equivalent to the US Coast Guard. Of course, those operations sit alongside a network of civilian administrators, as well as legal, medical, veterinary, and forestry personnel. But the key point is that this powerful organization sets its own internal policy, and no local police department, military wing, or even federal law enforcement agency is allowed to work inside a national park without local or regional clearance, or sometimes even consent from DC. So let's return to missing persons with this information. Pylades claims that his journey began when he was on holiday in Yellowstone National Park in the early 2000s. He says that two park employees recognized him from his true crime books and asked if he might know anyone who could look into a number of historic missing persons cases in the park. These civilian workers suspected negligence on the part of their employers, who they accused of shirking responsibility for solving these potential crimes. And on inspection, Pylades discovered that there were indeed several missing children in the region,
that their cases could be clustered by date and location, and that these cases appeared to have occurred with some consistency across the last 30 years. However, there was hardly any information about these people available other than in old newspaper coverage. So taking this on board, he issued several Freedom of Information requests asking for data related to these cases. And to his surprise, Pylades received a reply stating that the National Parks Service keeps no records of missing persons on its land, either in Yellowstone or anywhere else. In other words, if you disappear in a national park and are reported missing by a concerned friend or relative, a search and rescue effort will ensue. But if you're not located inside the time or costs permitted by park management, you are effectively written off by the institution. More to the point, your name is not even recorded for future reference. Parks are not obliged to follow up on these failed searches, and any decision to call in external support, investigate further, or press charges in suspicious cases always resides entirely with executives at the National Parks Service. Now, this all sounds odd to me, but then again, I found myself asking how many people actually do go missing in these wilderness areas. How likely is it for a body to go unfound there? And how often are potential crimes even overlooked? But much like Pylades, I soon discovered that these lines of inquiry encounter an impasse. Because in the absence of a database, how does one even answer those questions? Based at Yellowstone, Pylades attempted to address this in the early 2000s. He trawled through press coverage relating to various missing persons in the region. On locating a cold case, he began to interview the people involved, and during that process, Pylades encountered a common concern amongst these interviewees, many of whom claimed that cases had been abandoned despite strange circumstances. For instance, search and rescue specialists repeatedly told Pylades that they had called in anomalies that suggested a crime, but that park executives had either refused them resources or closed down a search at the time. Pylades began to write about the situation in online forums, arguing that a public database was desperately needed to track cold cases. And in turn, he started receiving emails. But rather than answers, these contained case after case of similarly questionable disappearances. And after a year or so, he'd amassed a huge collection of cold cases with clusters apparent in every single U.S. National Park. One of these was, of course, the case of Jared Atodero, the topic of some of those conspiracy theories I mentioned. But let's deal with history before hypothesis. Pylades decided that he could not sit by. Instead, he planned to examine these events on his own. Child by unfortunate child. As Pylades notes in the foreword to his first book, it was from these cases that he began to create a profile, observing similarities between events in which his data suggested more than an accidental death or disappearance. That profile has since gained notoriety in the true crime sphere, and though Pylades never itemizes it in his work, after reading through a few thousand pages of his case notes, I have attempted to reconstruct it for this podcast. And my version goes something like this. A child disappears in a national park. Park rangers investigate all associated individuals but don't press charges. Animal predation is dismissed on the advice of wildlife experts. Trained search and rescue personnel are deployed, but they are unable to locate any evidence. Likewise, specialist dog teams are unable or unwilling to find a trail, despite good conditions. Then, local law enforcement officers want to continue the search, but this is not permitted by their management. In the end, predatory animals or harsh terrain are blamed by park authorities, despite contrary advice issued by their own specialists. But there's more to the profile than this. Because remains or possessions are often recovered after the initial search, but these are often found too far from the point of disappearance for the lost child to have travelled there alone, over impassable terrain, or in areas that have already been searched by experienced teams. Like Jared's shoes, those items usually show no signs of animal predation besides natural wear and tear from insects, rodents, or small birds. In other words, this profile heavily implies that a victim was abducted. And the key thing to remember here is that this is not some arbitrary list of criteria, but a profile created from probable data drawn from numerous actual cases with these features in common. The volume and comparable qualities of these disappearances should at least have raised some suspicions about organized crime. Surely, something that might have been investigated by the FBI were these events not taking place inside protected national parks. Instead, though, authorities often intervened to obscure those conclusions at the time. In short then, without saying it outright, Palaides' work suggests a cover-up. At best, of widespread managerial incompetence, and at worst, of criminal events known about and deliberately obscured by the National Parks Service. Now, I am not a paranoid person. As listeners will know, I like thorough research and I don't like hasty conclusions. I'm also not a Make America Great Again Flat Earth 5G anti-vax apocalypse talk radio pundit. But if I'm completely honest, I do think Palaides might be onto something with this. After all, I was able to look into many of these cases myself, and I managed to confirm his data every single time. So something is clearly going on. The question isn't whether it is, rather, it's what it is, and why it's being hidden. And then there's something else. Something even stranger. For the last few weeks, I've been trawling through cases like these, and as I read my way through books by Palaides, the plot seems to thicken, because this pattern is not limited to missing children. That was simply the first place Palaides looked, and as he kept looking, it became increasingly clear that nearly identical circumstances have surrounded the disappearance of hundreds of adults too. From hikers to fishermen, hunters, and even people driving through the national parks, cases abound in which adults have vanished under similarly eerie circumstances. Two cases really stand out to me. These are ones that I've done my own research on, and for which I can verify the facts. They're also two of the cases that most defied explanation, and convinced me that someone or something is taking these people. Forgive me if they're a little rough, but let me give them to you as I have them, from my notes. They are the death of Aaron Hedges, who went missing in the Crazy Mountains, and the disappearance of Tom Messick, who vanished in upstate New York and was never found. Aaron's case is particularly interesting because he went missing whilst with friends when they became separated, and despite the fact that he was a well-trained and well-experienced outdoorsman in his prime, in his 30s, armed with a pistol and a bow, not someone you would imagine an easy victim. He still vanished though, and he vanished on a trail that he was familiar with in an area that he was used to hunting. And the interesting thing about Aaron's disappearance is that he had a radio on him that transmitted an intermittent GPS signal. Yet his friends, who were waiting for him while he scouted ahead to a camp they'd built on previous years, when they pinged his radio, it gave out coordinates in a completely different area to the one in which he was meant to be. So they split up to look for him. One friend went to the camp, and the other to the location sent by the radio. Neither of them could find anything, though. And then a snowstorm blew into the Crazy Mountains, forcing them to retreat. Of course, they called him in as a missing person, fearing he may be stuck in the storm. As in other cases like that of Jared Atadero, hundreds of people turned up, including search and rescue professionals, helicopters, dog teams, and volunteers. But they could not find anything. Yet 3 weeks later, a follow-up search was returning from deeper in the mountains via a route they'd taken to go in through a location that had already been searched. And they found Aaron's boots in the middle of the trail, sat in a granite boulder field. Much like Jared's sneakers, they were in great condition, undamaged by the weather. This location wasn't far from the coordinates sent by Aaron's radio, and it had been investigated by dog teams, flown over multiple times by helicopters, and combed by volunteers. Yet no one had found anything at the time. And that snowstorm, combined with Aaron's removing his boots, should have meant that footprints were created and a scent trail, which should have been easy to trace. And then, years later, the owners of a nearby farm at the bottom of the Crazy Mountains found a backpack and a bow leant up against a tree on the edge of their property. The backpack contained Aaron's loaded, undischarged pistol, his hunting and driver's licenses, credit cards, maps, matches, and even 4 uneaten protein bars, suggesting that he was out there and he didn't even get hungry. None of this made sense, though, because Aaron had left his spare boots at camp. So, to have reached this location, he would have had to have hiked 15 miles as the crow flies, in socks, in a snowstorm, over ice and sharp rocks, somehow without leaving any trace, and then, for some reason, have left his supplies on the edge of civilization. And then, another 6 months later, 5 miles back into the mountains and over a ridgeline, laborers on the edge of another remote ranch discovered a human skull placed on top of a bench on the fence line. Of course, it was taken for DNA sampling and diagnostics, and as I'm sure you can imagine, it was proven to be the skull of Aaron Hedges. In the following weeks, rangers found numerous other bones of Aaron scattered along the sides of nearby trails. So how the hell did they get there? And why was this case, much like Jared Atadero's, written off as an accidental death? Despite a total lack of circumstantial evidence, the National Park Service wrote it off as simply hypothermia. Hypothermia! Case closed. Bizarre. And then there's Tom Messick, who was on a hunting trip with friends and relatives in the woods in Horicon in 2015. Messick's case is fascinating because he might have been a retired paratrooper and survival expert, but he was also in his 80s and struggled to walk. His friends were a few feet away from him when he disappeared, and everyone was heavily armed. He'd sat down against a large granite boulder just meters away from his best friend and sons. But when the party regrouped at their nearby cars, Messick didn't turn up. Like in the case of Aaron Hedges, they radioed him, thinking that he may have fallen asleep. They couldn't get through, though. His sons walked to the boulder at which he'd been sat, but he was gone. So were his rifle and backpack. Not only should no one have been walking away from their position during a hunt, after all, Messick was a very experienced hunter and he knew that anyone moving in the woods would risk being shot, there was also no way that he would have been able to go far in his condition. Yet there was no sign of him anywhere nearby. His sons, wife, and friends all searched for him for hours, and by the next day, a rescue effort had moved in. It included all the usual: dog teams, trackers, helicopters with infrared, even divers checking the nearby lakes. But of course, nothing was found. Nothing at all in a 10-mile radius. And most interesting of all, the FBI turned up on the scene. Although, as we know from before, they weren't actually allowed to intervene in the search itself, they conducted interviews with search and rescue personnel. Now to me, that sounds like the FBI might be investigating disappearances like this from the sidelines, perhaps building their own profile on whatever is going on in the national parks. Nonetheless, the search was eventually postponed, and to this day, no one has found Messick, or the weapon and backpack that should have been too heavy for him to carry more than a few yards from his last known position. A little side note. That same week, A local to the area in which Messick vanished, the similarly aged Frederick Drum, also disappeared without a trace. From his own home, on the edge of the park. Dale Sterling, Joe Keller, Morgan Heimer, Chris Fowler, Gloria Wood, Maureen Kelly, Eric Corn-Kevin, Minnie Horn, and so many others. These are all cases that I've looked into myself and that I simply can't explain. Nor can I explain why, after so many of these disappearances, the National Park Service seem so keen to call off searches and so happy to wipe these people from their records. So at the end of this episode, perhaps my only conclusion is that this mystery does need to be looked into. Because after weeks of research, I find myself agreeing with Pylades, compelled by the sheer weight of the data. And I agree with you listeners too, those of you who've urged me to look into this topic and to ask what might cause these disappearances, and why a cover-up might be associated with whatever that is. And that's where we'll pick up next episode, after looking into the many suggestions you've already sent me about what might be behind this mystery, and after talking to some interviewees of my own, who I hope to get onto the show. So, thank you so much for listening tonight. I hope you're feeling as intrigued and perhaps as uncomfortable as I am. I hope you're looking forward to diving in deeper too. And of course, if you think you have any ideas or anything that might help with the investigation, please do email it over to me. You know my email address, it's adrian.thestrangeness@gmail.com. If you know anything about this subject yourself and you think that you might be a good interviewee, by all means, please get in touch. I'd also like to let any new listeners know that we've started running case notes alongside each episode, so you can check those out on the website. Do dig in, and if you find anything interesting, don't forget to tweet me about it or send me an email. You could also do the show a massive favour by checking out the show image and letting me know if your podcast player has updated the typo. That would be an amazing help. Thank you so much. And before we close out, I'd just like to remind you that we do have a Patreon, so if you've enjoyed what you've listened to, you can always subscribe, and the prices are locked in for the next month. They may go up after that, but they're locked in for now, so grab it while you can. And if this episode has left you feeling unsafe, our sponsor for today can't do much about you in the wilderness or on a lonely walk home, but they can keep you safe in your home. That's Simply Safe Home Security. So please, do go check them out. And to wrap things up, I've been Adrian Asahi, your faithful guide into the unknown. And you have been listening to The Strangeness. So remember, folks, stay safe, stay well, and above all else, stay strange.